Strange glanced up the venerable staircase to the great carved doors behind which his lordship sat, curious how everyone who entered knew instinctively where he was to be found. Such is the fascination that great men exert. Strange showed no inclination to go. Colonel Murray supposed that he must be feeling lonely. A tall man with vivid black eyebrows and long black moustaches to match approached the table. He wore the dark blue jacket and gold braid of the light dragoons. "Where have you put the French prisoners?" he demanded of Colonel Murray. "In the belfry," said Colonel Murray. "That will do," said the man. "I only ask because last night Colonel Percy put three Frenchmen in a little shed, thinking they could do no harm there. But it seems some lads of the 52nd had previously put some chickens in the shed, and during the night the Frenchmen ate the chickens. Colonel Percy said that this morning several of his lads were eyeing the French in a very particular manner, as if wondering how much of the flavour of the chickens had got into the Frenchmen, and whether it might not be worth cooking one of them to find out." "Oh," said Colonel Murray, "there is no danger of anything like that happening tonight. The only other creatures in the belfry are the rats, and I should think that if anyone's going to eat anyone else, the rats will eat the Frenchmen." Colonel Murray, General Stuart, and the man with black moustaches began to laugh, when suddenly they were interrupted by the magician saying, "The road between Espinhal and Lusau is abominably bad." This was the road along which a substantial part of the British army had come that day. Colonel Murray agreed that the road was very bad indeed. Strange continued, "I cannot tell how many times today my horse stumbled into potholes and slipped in the mud. I was certain she would fall lame, yet it was no worse than any of the other roads that I've seen since I arrived here. And tomorrow, I understand, some of us must go where there are no roads whatsoever." Yes, said Colonel Murray, wishing very heartily that the magician would go away. "Through flooded rivers and stony plains and through woods and thickets, I suppose," said Strange. "That will be very bad for all of us. I dare say we shall make very poor progress. I dare say we shall not get on at all. It is one of the disadvantages of waging war in such a backward, out-of-the-way place as Portugal," said Colonel Murray. General Stuart said nothing, but the angry look he gave the magician expressed quite clearly his opinion that perhaps Mr. Strange would make better progress if he and his horse took themselves back to London. To take 40,000 men and all their horses and carts and equipment across such an abominable country, no one in England would believe it possible. Strange laughed. "It is a pity that his lordship cannot spare a moment to talk to me, but perhaps you'll be as good as to give him a message. Say this: Mr. Strange presents his compliments to Lord Wellington and says that if it is of any interest to his lordship to have a nice, well-made road for the army to march along tomorrow, then Mr. Strange will be glad to conjure up one for him. Oh, and if he wishes, he may have bridges, too, to replace the ones the French have blown up. Good evening to you." With that, Strange bowed to both gentlemen, picked up his umbrella, and left. Strange and Jeremy Johns had been unable to find anywhere to stay in Lusau. None of the gentlemen who found quarters for the generals and told the rest of the soldiers which damp field they were to sleep in had made any provision for the magician and his servant. Strange had eventually agreed terms for a tiny upstairs room with a man who kept a little wine shop a few miles down the road to Miranda de Corvo. Strange and Jeremy ate the supper the wine shop owner had provided for them. It was a stew, and their evening's entertainment chiefly consisted in trying to guess what had gone into it. "What the devil is that?" asked Strange, holding up his fork. On the end of it was something whitish and glistening that curled over and under itself. "A fish, perhaps," ventured Jeremy. "It looks more like a snail," said Strange. "Or part of someone's ear," added Jeremy. Strange stared at it a moment longer. "Would you like it?" he asked. "No, thank you, sir," said Jeremy, with a resigned glance into his own cracked plate. "I've several of my own." When they had finished supper, and when the last candle had burnt out, there seemed nothing else to do but to go to bed, and so they did. Jeremy curled up upon one side of the room, and Strange lay down upon the other. Each had devised his own bed from whatever materials had taken his fancy. Jeremy had a mattress fashioned out of his spare clothes, and Strange had a pillow formed chiefly of books from Mr. Norrell's library. All at once, there came the sound of someone's horse galloping up the road to the little wine shop. This was quickly followed by the sound of someone's boots pounding up the rickety stairs, which in turn was followed by the sound of someone's fist pounding on the ramshackle door. The door opened, and a smart young man in the uniform of the Hussars half tumbled into the room. The smart young man was somewhat out of breath, but managed to convey between gulps of air that Lord Wellington presented his compliments to Mr. Strange, and that if all was convenient to Mr. Strange, Lord Wellington would like to speak to him immediately. At Jose Estrella's house, Wellington was at dinner with a number of his staff officers and other gentlemen. Strange could have sworn that the gentlemen at the table had all been engaged in the liveliest conversation up to the moment when he entered the room. But now all fell silent. This rather suggested that they'd been talking about him.
"Ah, Strange," cried Lord Wellington, raising a glass in greeting. "There you are. I've had three aides-de-camp looking for you all evening. I wish to invite you to dinner, but my boys could not find you. Sit down anyway, and have some champagne and dessert."
Strange looked rather wistfully at the remains of the dinner, which the servants were clearing away. Among other good things Strange believed he recognized were the remains of some roast geese, the shells from buttered prawns, half a ragout of celery, and the ends of some spicy Portuguese sausages. He thanked his lordship and sat down. A servant brought him a glass of champagne, and he helped himself to almond tart and dried cherries.
"And how do you like the war, Mr. Strange?"
asked a fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman at the other end of the table.
"Oh, it is a little confusing at first, like most things," said Strange. "But having now experienced many of the adventures a war affords, I grow used to it. I've been robbed once. I've been shot at once. Once I found a Frenchman in the kitchen and had to chase him out, and once the house I was sleeping in was set on fire."
"By the French?" inquired General Stuart.
By the English. There was a company of the 43rd who were apparently very cold that night, and so they set fire to the house to warm themselves."
"Oh, that always happens," said General Stuart.
There was a little pause, and then another gentleman in a cavalry uniform said,
"We have been talking, arguing, rather, about magic and how it's done. Strathclyde says that you and the other magician have given every word in the Bible a number, and you look for the words to make up the spell, and then you add the numbers together, and then you do something else, and then—"
"That was not what I said," complained another person, presumably Strathclyde. "You've not understood at all."
"I'm afraid I have never done anything remotely resembling what you describe," said Strange. "It seems rather complicated, and I do not think it would work. As to how I do magic, there are many, many procedures, as many, I dare say, as for making war."
"I should like to do magic," said the fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman at the other end of the table. "I should have a ball every night with fairy music and fairy fireworks, and I would summon all the most beautiful women out of history to attend. Helen of Troy, Cleopatra, Lucrezia Borgia, Maid Marian, and Madame Pompadour. I should bring them all here to dance with you fellows, and when the French appeared on the horizon, I would just—" he waved his arm vaguely— "do something, you know, and they would all fall down dead."
"Can a magician kill a man by magic?"
Lord Wellington asked Strange. Strange frowned. He seemed to dislike the question.
"I suppose a magician might," he admitted. "But a gentleman never could."
Lord Wellington nodded, as if this was just what he would have expected. And then he said,
"This road, Mr. Strange, which you have been so good as to offer us, what sort of road would it be?"
"Oh, the details are the easiest thing in the world to arrange, my lord. What sort of road would you like?"
The officers and gentlemen around Lord Wellington's dinner table looked at each other. They had not given the matter any thought.
"A chalk road, perhaps?" said Strange helpfully. "A chalk road is pretty."
"Too dusty in the dry, and a river of mud in the rain," said Lord Wellington. "No, no, a chalk road will never do. A chalk road is scarcely better than no road at all."
"What about a cobbled road?" suggested Colonel Murray.
"Cobbles will make the men's boots wear out," said Wellington.
"And besides, the artillery will not like it," said the fox-haired, fox-faced gentleman. "They will have a devil of a time dragging the guns along a cobbled road."
Someone else suggested a gravel road, but that, thought Wellington, was liable to the same objection as a chalk road. It would become a river of mud in the rain, and the Portuguese did seem to think that it would rain again tomorrow.
No, said his lordship. I believe, Mr. Strange, that what would suit us best would be a road along the Roman pattern, with a nice ditch upon either side to drain off the water, and good flat stones well fitted together on top.
Very well, said Strange.
We set off at daybreak,
said Wellington. Then, my lord, if someone would be good enough to show me where the road ought to go, I shall see to it immediately. By morning, the road was in place, and Lord Wellington rode along it on Copenhagen, his favourite horse, and Strange rode beside him on Egyptian, who was his favourite horse. In his customary decisive manner, Wellington pointed out those things which he particularly liked about the road, and those things which he did not.
But really, I have hardly any criticisms to make. It is an excellent road. I may make it a little wider tomorrow, if you please.
Lord Wellington and Strange agreed that, as a general rule, the road should be in place a couple of hours before the first regiment stepped upon it, and disappear an hour after the last soldier had passed along it. This was to prevent the French army from gaining any benefit from the roads. The success of this plan depended on Wellington's staff providing Strange with accurate information as to when the army was likely to begin and end marching. Obviously, these calculations were not always correct. A week or so after the first appearance of the road, Colonel Mackenzie of the 11th Foot came to see Lord Wellington in a great temper and complained that the magician had allowed the road to disappear before his regiment could reach it.
By the time we got to Celerico, my lord, it was disappearing under our feet. An hour after that, it had vanished entirely. Could not the magician summon up visions to find out what the different regiments are doing? I can understand that this is something he can do very easily. Then he could make sure that the roads do not disappear until everyone is finished with them.
Lord Wellington said sharply,
"The magician has a great deal to do. Beresford needs roads."
Footnote 3. There were three great fortresses which guarded the border into Spain: Almeida, Badajoz, and Ciudad Rodriguez. In the early months of 1811, all three were held by the French. While Wellington advanced upon the Almeida, he dispatched General Beresford with the Portuguese army to besiege the fortress of Badajoz further south.
I need roads. I really cannot ask Mr. Strange to be forever peering into mirrors and bowls of water to discover where every stray regiment has got to. You and your lads must keep up, Colonel Mackenzie. That is all.
Shortly after this, the British headquarters received intelligence of something that had befallen a large part of the French army as it was marching from Guarda to Sabugal. A patrol had been sent out to look at the road between the two towns, but some Portuguese had come along and told the patrol that this was one of the English magician's roads, and was certain to disappear in an hour or two, taking everyone upon it to hell, or possibly England. As soon as this rumour reached the ears of the soldiers, they declined absolutely to walk along the road, which was, in fact, perfectly real, and had existed for almost 1,000 years. Instead, the French followed some serpentine route over mountains and through rocky valleys that wore out their boots and tore their clothes and delayed them for several days. Lord Wellington could not have been more delighted. Chapter 30. The Book of Robert Filmhelm. January to February, 1812. The magician's house is expected to have certain peculiarities, but the most peculiar feature of Mr. Norrell's house was, without a doubt, Childermas. In no other household in London was there any servant like him. One day he might be observed removing a dirty cup and wiping crumbs from a table like a common footman. The next day he would interrupt a room full of admirals, generals, and noblemen to tell them in what particulars he considered them mistaken. Mr. Norrell had once publicly reprimanded the Duke of Devonshire for speaking at the same time as Childermas. On a misty day at the end of January 1812, Childermas entered the library at Hanover Square, where Mr. Norrell was working, and briefly informed him that he was obliged to go away upon business, and did not know when he would return. Then, having given the other servants various instructions about the work they were to do in his absence, he mounted his horse and rode away. In the 3 weeks that followed, Mr. Norrell received 4 letters from him, one from Newark in Nottinghamshire, one from York in the East Riding of Yorkshire, one from Richmond in the North Riding of Yorkshire, and one from Sheffield in the West Riding of Yorkshire. But the letters were only about business matters, and threw no light upon his mysterious journey. He returned one night in the second half of February. Lascelles and Drawlight had dined at Hanover Square and were in the drawing-room with Mr. Norrell when Childermas entered. He came directly from the stables. His boots and breeches were splashed with mud, and his coat was still damp with rain.
"Where in the world have you been?" demanded Mr. Norrell.
"In Yorkshire," said Childermas, "making inquiries about Vinculus."
"Did you see Vinculus?" asked Drawlight eagerly.
"No, I did not."
"Do you know where he is?" asked Mr. Norrell.
"No, I do not."
"Have you found Vinculus's book?" asked Lascelles.
"No, I have not."
"Tut," said Lascelles.
He eyed Childermas disapprovingly.
"If you take my advice, Mr. Norrell, you will not permit Mr. Childermas to waste any more time upon Vinculus. No one has heard or seen anything of him for years. He is probably dead."
Childermas sat down upon the sofa, like a man who had a perfect right to do so, and said,
"The cards say he's not dead. The cards say he's still alive, and still has the book."
"The cards, the cards," cried Mr. Norrell. "I have told you 1,000 times how I detest any mention of those objects. You will oblige me by removing them from my house and never speaking of them again."
Childermas threw his master a cool look.
"Do you wish to hear what I have learnt, or not?" he asked.
Mr. Norrell nodded sullenly.
"Good," said Childermas. "In your interest, Mr. Norrell, I have taken care to improve my acquaintance with all Vinculus's wives. It has always seemed to me nigh on impossible that one of them did not know something that would help us. It seemed to me that all I had to do was to go with them to enough gin houses, buy them enough gin, and let them talk, and eventually one of them would reveal it to me. Well, I was right. 3 weeks ago, Nan Purvis told me a story which finally put me on the track of Vinculus's book."
Which one is Nan Purvis?" inquired Lascelles.
"The first. She told me something that happened 20 or 30 years ago, when Vinculus and she were first married. They'd been drinking at a gin house. They had spent their money and exhausted their credit, and it was time to return to their lodgings. They staggered along the street, and in the gutter they saw a creature even worse for drink than themselves. An old man was lying there, dead drunk. The filthy water flowed round him and over his face, and it was only by chance that he did not drown. Something about this wretch caught Vinculus's eye. It seemed that he recognized him. He went and peered at him, and then he laughed and gave the old man a vicious kick. Nan asked Vinculus who the old man was. Vinculus said his name was Clegg. She asked him how he knew him. Vinculus replied angrily that he did not know Clegg. He said he had never known Clegg. What was more, he told her, he was determined never to know him. In short, there was no one in the world whom he despised more than Clegg. When Nan complained that this was not a very full explanation, Vinculus grudgingly said that the man was his father. After this, he refused to say any more."
"But what has this to do with anything?" interrupted Mr. Norrell. "Why do you not ask these wives of Vinculus about the book?"
Childermas looked annoyed.
"I did so, sir, 4 years ago. You may remember I told you. None of them knew anything about it."
With an exasperated wave of his hand, Mr. Norrell indicated that Childermas was to continue.
"Some months later, Nan was in a tavern, listening to an account of a hanging at York that someone was reading from a newspaper. Nan loved to hear of a good hanging, and this report particularly impressed her because the name of the man who'd been executed was Clegg. It stuck in her mind, and that evening she told Vinculus. To her surprise, she found that he already knew all about it, and that it was indeed his father. Vinculus was delighted Clegg had been hanged. He said Clegg richly deserved it. He said Clegg had been guilty of a terrible crime, the worst crime committed in England in the last 100 years.
"What crime?" asked Lascelles.
"At first Nan could not bring it to mind," said Childermas. "But with a little persistent questioning, and the promise of more gin, she remembered. He had stolen a book."
"A book!" exclaimed Mr. Norrell.
"Oh, Mr. Norrell,"
cried Drawlight. "It must be the same book. It must be Vinculus's book."
"Is it?" asked Mr. Norrell.
"I believe so," said Childermass.
"But did this woman know what the book was?" said Mr. Norrell.
"No. That was the end of Nan's information. So, I rode north to York, where Clegg had been tried and executed, and I examined the records of the quarter sessions. The first thing I discovered was that Clegg was originally from Richmond in Yorkshire. Oh, yes."
Here Childermass glanced meaningfully at Mr. Norrell.
"Vinculus is, by descent at least, a Yorkshireman."
Footnote 1. Yorkshire was part of the Raven King's kingdom of northern England. Childermass and Norrell's respect for Vinculus would have increased a little, knowing that he was, like them, a northerner.
"Clegg began his life as a tightrope walker at the northern fairs, but as tightrope walking is not a trade that combines well with drinking, and Clegg was a famous drinker, he was obliged to give it up. He returned to Richmond and hired himself out as a servant on a prosperous farm. He did well there, and impressed the farmer with his cleverness, so that he began to be entrusted with more and more business. From time to time he would go drinking with bad companions, and on these occasions he never stopped at one bottle or two. He drank until the spigots gave out and the cellars were emptied. He was mad drunk for days, and in that time he got up to all sorts of mischief. Thieving, gambling, fighting, destruction of property. But he always made sure that these wild adventures took place far away from the farm, and he always had some plausible excuse to explain his absence, so that his master, the farmer, never suspected anything was amiss, though the other servants knew all about it. The farmer's name was Robert Findholm. He was a quiet, kindly, respectable sort of man, the sort of man easily deceived by a rogue like Clegg. The farm had been in his family for generations. But once, long ago, it had been one of the granges of the Abbey of Easby.
Mr. Norrell drew in his breath sharply and fidgeted in his chair.
Lascelles looked inquiringly at him.
"Easby Abbey was one of the foundations of the Raven King," explained Mr. Norrell.
"As was Hurtview," added Childermass.
"Indeed," said Lascelles in surprise.
Footnote 2. Many people besides Lascelles remarked upon the odd circumstance that Mr. Norrell, who hated any mention of the Raven King, should have lived in a house built of stones, quarried upon the king's instruction, and upon land which the king had once owned and knew well.
"I confess that after all you've said about him, I'm surprised that you live in a house so closely connected to him."
"You do not understand," said Mr. Norrell irritably. "We are speaking of Yorkshire, of John Usglass's kingdom of northern England, where he lived and ruled for 300 years. There is scarcely a village, scarcely a field even, that does not have some close connection with him."
Childermass continued.
"Findholm's family possessed something else that had once belonged to the abbey, a treasure that had been given into their keeping by the last abbot, and which was handed down from father to son with the land."
"Book of magic?" asked Norrell eagerly.
"If what they told me in Yorkshire is true, it was more than a book of magic. It was the book of magic. A book written by the Raven King and set down in his own hand."
There was a silence.
"Is this possible?"
Lascelles asked Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell did not answer. He was sitting deep in thought, wholly taken up with this new, and not altogether, pleasant idea. At last he spoke, but it was more as if he were speaking his thoughts out loud rather than answering Lascelles' question.
"A book belonging to Raven King, or written by him, is one of the great follies of English magic. Several people have imagined that they have found it, or that they know where it is hidden. Some of them were clever men who might have written important works of scholarship, but instead wasted their lives in pursuit of the king's book. But that is not to say that such a book might not exist somewhere."
"And if it did exist," urged Lascelles, "and if it were found, what then?"
Mr. Norrell shook his head and would not reply.
Childermass answered for him. then all of English magic would have to be reinterpreted in the light of what was found there. Lascelles raised an eyebrow.
Is this true? He asked.
Mr. Norrell hesitated and looked very much as if he would like to say that it was not.
Do you believe that this was the king's book?
Lascelles asked Childermas. Childermas shrugged.
Findhelm certainly believed it. In Richmond, I discovered two old people who had been servants in Findhelm's house in their youth. They said that the king's book was the pride of his existence. He was guardian of the book, first and all else. Husband, parent, farmer, second.
Childermas paused.
The greatest glory and the greatest burden given to any man in this age, he mused. Findhelm seems to have been a theoretical magician himself in a small way. He bought books about magic and paid a magician in Northallerton to teach him. But one thing struck me as very curious. Both these old servants insisted that Findhelm never read the king's book and had only the vaguest notion of what it contained.
Ah, exclaimed Mr. Norrell softly.
Lascelles and Childermas looked at him.
So, he could not read it, said Mr. Norrell. Well, that is very...
He fell silent and began to chew on his fingernails.
Perhaps it was in Latin, suggested Lascelles.
And why do you assume that Findhelm did not know Latin?
Replied Childermas with some irritation.
Just because he was a farmer.
Oh, I meant no disrespect to farmers in general. I assure you, laughed Lascelles. The occupation has its utility. But farmers are not in general known for their classical scholarship. Or would this person have even recognized Latin when he saw it?
Childermas retorted that of course Findhelm would have recognized Latin. He was not a fool. To which Lascelles coldly replied that he had never said he was. The quarrel was becoming heated when they were both suddenly silenced by Mr. Norrell saying slowly and thoughtfully,
When the Raven King first came into England, he could not read and write. Few people could in those days, even kings. And the Raven King had been brought up in a fairy house where there was no writing. He had never even seen writing before. His new human servants showed it to him and explained its purpose. But he was a young man then, a very young man, perhaps no more than 14 or 15 years of age. He had already conquered kingdoms in 2 different worlds, and he had all the magic a magician could desire. He was full of arrogance and pride. He had no wish to read other men's thoughts. What were other men's thoughts compared to his own? So he refused to learn to read and write Latin, which was what his servants wanted, and instead he invented a writing of his own to preserve his thoughts for later times. Presumably this writing mirrored the workings of his own mind more closely than Latin could have done. That was at the very beginning. But the longer he remained in England, the more he changed, becoming less silent, less solitary, less like a fairy, and more like a man. Eventually he consented to learn to read and write as other men did, but he did not forget his own writing, the king's letters, as it is called, and he taught it to certain favored magicians so that they might understand his magic more perfectly. Martin Pale mentions the king's letters, and so does Bellasis, but neither of them had ever seen so much as a single penstroke of it. If a piece of it has survived, and in the king's own hand, then certainly.
Mr. Norrell fell silent again.
Well, Mr. Norrell, said Lascelles, you are full of surprises tonight. So much admiration for a man you have always claimed to hate and despise. My admiration does not lessen my hatred one whit, said Mr. Norrell sharply. I said he was a great magician. I did not say he was a good man, nor that I welcomed his influence upon English magic. Beside, what you have just heard was my private opinion, and not for public circulation. Childermas knows. Childermas understands.
Mr. Norrell glanced nervously at Drawlight. But Drawlight had stopped listening some time ago, just as soon as he discovered that Childermas's story concerned no one in the fashionable world, but only Yorkshire farmers and drunk servants. At present, He was busy polishing his snuff box with his handkerchief.
"So, Clegg stole this book," said Lascelles to Childermas. "Is that what you're going to tell us?"
"In a manner of speaking. In the autumn of 1754, Filmthelm gave the book to Clegg and told him to deliver it to a man in the village of Breton, in the Derbyshire Peak. Why, I do not know. Clegg set off, and on the second or third day of his journey, he reached Sheffield. He stopped at a tavern, and there he fell in with a man, a blacksmith by trade, whose reputation as a drinker was almost as extraordinary as his own. They began a drinking contest that lasted 2 days and two nights. At first they simply drank to see which of them could drink the most, but on the second day they began to set each other mad drunken challenges. There was a barrel of salted herrings in the corner. Clegg challenged the blacksmith to walk across a floor of herrings. An audience had gathered by this time, and all the lookers-on and the loungers about emptied out the herrings and paved the floor with fish. Then the blacksmith walked from one end of the room to the other till the floor was a stinking mess of pulp fish, and the blacksmith was bloody from head to foot with all the falls he had taken. Then the blacksmith challenged Clegg to walk along the edge of the tavern roof. Clegg had been drunk for a whole day by this time. Time after time the onlookers thought he was about to fall and break his worthless neck, but he never did. Then Clegg challenged the blacksmith to roast and eat his shoes, which the blacksmith did. And finally, the blacksmith challenged Clegg to eat Robert Findhelm's book. Clegg tore it into strips and ate it, piece by piece. Mr. Norrell gave a cry of horror. Even Lascelles blinked in surprise. "Days later," said Childermas, "when Clegg awoke, he realized what he had done. He made his way down to London, and 4 years after that, he tumbled a serving girl in a Wapping tavern, who was Vinculus's mother."
"But surely the explanation is clear," cried Mr. Norrell.
"The book is not lost at all. The story of the drinking contest was a mere invention of Clegg's to blind Finhelm to the truth. In reality, he kept the book and gave it to his son. Now, if we can only discover—"
"But why?" said Childermas. "Why should he go to all this trouble in order to procure the book for a son he had never seen and did not care about? Besides, Vinculus was not even born when Clegg set off on the road to Derbyshire."
Lascelles cleared his throat.
"For once, Mr. Norrell, I agree with Mr. Childermas. If Clegg still had the book or knew where it was to be found, then surely he would have produced it at his trial or tried to use it to bargain for his life."
"And if Vinculus had profited so much from his father's crime," added Childermas, "why did he hate his father? Why did he rejoice when his father was hanged? Robert Findhelm was quite sure the book was destroyed. That is plain. Nan told me Clegg had been hanged for stealing a book, but the charge Robert Findhelm brought against him was not theft. The charge Findhelm brought against him was book murder. Clegg was the last man in England to be hanged for book murder."
Footnote 3. Book murder was a late addition to English magical law. The willful destruction of a book of magic merited the same punishment as the murder of a Christian.
"So why does Vinculus claim to have this book if his father ate it?" said Lascelles in a wondering tone. "The thing is not possible.
Somehow Robert Findhelm's inheritance has passed to Vinculus, but how it happened, I do not pretend to understand," said Childermas.
"What of the man in Derbyshire?" asked Mr. Norrell suddenly. "You said that Findhelm was sending the book to a man in Derbyshire."
Childermas sighed.
"I passed through Derbyshire on my way back to London. I went to the village of Breton. 3 houses and an inn high on a bleak hill. Whoever the man was that Clegg was sent to seek out, he's long dead. I could discover nothing there."
Stephen Black and the gentleman with the thistle-down hair were seated in the upper room of Wharton's Coffee House in Oxford Street, where the Peopleday boys met. The gentleman was speaking, as he often did, of his great affection for Stephen.
"Which reminds me," he said, I've been meaning for many months to offer you an apology and an explanation.
An apology to me, sir?
Yes, Stephen. You and I wish for nothing in the world so much as Lady Pole's happiness. Yet I am bound by the terms of the magician's wicked agreement to return her to her husband's house each morning, where she must while away the long day until evening. But clever as you are, you must surely have observed that there are no such constraints upon you. And I dare say you are wondering why I do not take you away to Lost Hope House to be happy for ever and for ever.
I have wondered about that, sir, agreed Stephen.
He paused, because his whole future seemed to depend upon the next question.
Is there something which prevents you?
Yes, Stephen. In a way, there is.
I see, said Stephen. Well, that is most unfortunate.
Would not you like to know what it is?
Asked the gentleman. Oh, yes, sir. Indeed, sir.
Know then,
said the gentleman, putting on grave and important looks, quite unlike his usual expression,
that we fairy spirits know something of the future. Often fate chooses us as her vessels for prophecy. In the past, we have lent our aid to Christians to allow them to achieve great and noble destinies. Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Charlemagne, William Shakespeare, John Wesley, and so forth.
Footnote 4. Not all the worthies referred to by the gentleman are Christian. Just as we refer to a great many diverse tribes and races as fairies, so they commonly name us Christians, regardless of our religion, race, or era.
But often our knowledge of things to come is misty, and
the gentleman gestured furiously, as if he were brushing away thick cobwebs from in front of his face.
Imperfect. Out of my dear love for you, Stephen, I have traced the smoke of burning cities and battlefields, and prized dripping bloody guts out of dying men to discover your future. You are indeed destined to be a king. I must say that I am not in the least surprised. I felt strongly from the first that you should be a king, and it was most unlikely that I should be wrong. But more than this, I believe I know which kingdom is to be yours. The smoke and guts and all the other signs state quite clearly that it is to be a kingdom where you have already been, a kingdom with which you are already closely connected.
Stephen waited.
But do you not see? Cried the gentleman impatiently. It must be England. I cannot tell you how delighted I was when I learnt this important news.
England! Exclaimed Stephen.
Yes, indeed. Nothing could be more beneficial for England herself than that you should be her king. My present king is old and blind, and as for his sons, they are all fat and drunk. So now you see why I cannot take you away to Lost Hope. It would be wholly wrong of me to remove you from your rightful kingdom.
Stephen sat for a moment, trying to comprehend. But might not the kingdom be somewhere in Africa? He said at last. Perhaps I am destined to find my way back there, and perhaps by some strange portent the people will recognize me as the descendant of one of their kings.
Perhaps, said the gentleman doubtfully. But no, that cannot be. For you see, it is a kingdom where you have already been. And you never were in Africa. Oh, Stephen, how I long for your wonderful destiny to be accomplished. On that day, I shall ally my many kingdoms to Great Britain, and you and I shall live in perfect amity and brotherhood. Think how our enemies will be confounded. Think how eaten up with rage the magicians will be, how they will curse themselves that they did not treat us with more respect.
But I think that you must be mistaken, sir. I cannot rule England. Not with this.
He spread out his hands in front of him. Black skin, he thought. Aloud, he continued, only you, sir, with your partiality for me, could think such a thing possible. Slaves do not become kings, sir.
Slave, Stephen? Whatever do you mean?
I was born into slavery, sir, as are many of my race. My mother was a slave on an estate in Jamaica that Sir Walter's grandfather owned. When his debts grew too great, Sir William went to Jamaica to sell the estate, and one of the possessions which he brought back with him was my mother. Or rather, he intended to bring her back to be a servant in his house, but during the voyage she gave birth to me and died.
Ah! Exclaimed the gentleman in triumph. Then it is exactly as I have said. You and your estimable mother were enslaved by the wicked English and brought low by their machinations.
Well, yes, sir. That is true in a sense. But I am not a slave now. No one who stands on British soil can be a slave. The heir of England is the heir of liberty. It is a great boast of Englishmen that this is so. And yet, he thought, they own slaves in other countries. Out loud, he said, from the moment the Sir William's valet carried me as a tiny infant from the ship, I was free.
Nevertheless, we should punish them, cried the gentleman. We can easily kill Lady Pole's husband, and then I will descend into hell and find his grandfather, and then—
But it was not Sir William and Sir Walter who did the enslaving, protested Stephen. Sir Walter has always been very much opposed to the slave trade, and Sir William was kind to me. He had me christened and educated.
Christened? What? Even your name is an imposition of your enemies, signifying slavery. Then I strongly advise you to cast it off and choose another when you ascend the throne of England. What was the name your mother called you?
I do not know, sir. I am not sure that she called me anything. The gentleman narrowed his eyes as a sign that he was thinking hard.
It would be a strange sort of mother, he mused. They did not name her child. Yes, there would be a name that belongs to you, truly belongs to you. That much is clear to me. The name your mother called you in her heart during those precious moments when she held you in her arms. Are you not curious to know what it was?
Oh, certainly, sir. But my mother is long dead. She may never have told that name to another soul. Her own name is lost. Once, when I was a boy, I asked Sir William, but he could not remember it.
Doubtless he knew it well, but in his malice would not tell it to you. It would need someone very remarkable to recover your name, Stephen, someone with extraordinary talents and incomparable nobility of character. Me, in fact. Yes, that is what I will do. As a token of the love I bear you, I will find your true name.
Chapter 31. 17 Dead Neapolitans. April 1812 to June 1814. There were in the British Army at that time a number of exploring officers, whose business it was to talk to the local people, to steal French armies' letters, and always to know the whereabouts of the French troops. Let your notions of war be as romantic as they may, Wellington's exploring officers would always exceed them. They forded rivers by moonlight and crossed mountain ranges under the searing sun. They lived more behind French lines than English ones and knew everyone favourable to the British cause. The greatest of these exploring officers was, without a doubt, Major Colhern Grant of the 11th Foot. Often the French would look up from whatever they were doing and see Major Grant on horseback, observing them from atop a far-off hill. He would peer at them through his telescope and then make notes about them in his little notebook. It made them most uncomfortable. One morning in April 1812, quite by chance, Major Grant found himself caught between two French cavalry patrols. When it became clear that he could not outride them, he abandoned his horse and hid in a little wood. Major Grant always considered himself to be a soldier rather than a spy, and as a soldier, he made it a point of honour to wear his uniform at all times. Unfortunately, the uniform of the 11th Foot, as of almost all infantry regiments, was bright scarlet. And as he hid amongst the budding spring leaves, the French had no difficulty whatsoever in perceiving him. For the British, the capture of Grant was a calamity akin to losing a whole brigade of ordinary men. Lord Wellington immediately sent out urgent messages, some to the French generals proposing an exchange of prisoners, and some to the guerrilla commanders. Footnote 1. Guerrilla, a Spanish word meaning little war. Guerrilla bands were groups of Spaniards numbering between dozens and thousands who fought and harassed the French armies. Some were led by ex-soldiers and maintained an impressive degree of military discipline. Others were little more than bandits and devoted as much of their energies to terrifying their own unfortunate countrymen as they did to fighting the French. Promising them silver dollars and weapons aplenty if they could effect Grant's rescue. When neither of these proposals produced any results, Lord Wellington was obliged to try a different plan. He hired one of the most notorious and ferocious of all the guerrilla chieftains, Geronimo Sileneal, to convey Jonathan Strange to Major Grant.
"You will find that Sileneal is rather a formidable person," Lord Wellington informed Strange before he set off. "But I have no fears upon that account, because frankly, Mr. Strange, so are you."
Sileneal and his men were indeed as murderous a set of villains as you could wish to see. They were dirty, evil-smelling, and unshaven. They had sabers and knives stuck into their belts and rifles slung over their shoulders. Their clothes and saddle blankets were covered with cruel and deadly images, skulls and crossbones, hearts impaled upon knives, gallows, crucifixions upon cartwheels, ravens pecking at hearts and eyes, and other such pleasant devices. These images were formed out of what appeared at first to be pearl buttons, but which on closer examination proved to be the teeth of all the Frenchmen they had killed. Sileneal in particular had so many teeth attached to his person that he rattled whenever he moved, rather as if all the dead Frenchmen were still chattering with fear. Surrounded as they were by the symbols and accoutrements of death, Sileneal and his men were confident of striking terror into everyone they met. They were, therefore, a little disconcerted to find that the English magician had outdone them in this respect. He had brought a coffin with him. Like many violent men, they were also rather superstitious. One of them asked Strange what was inside the coffin. He replied carelessly that it contained a man. After several days of hard riding, the guerrilla band brought Strange to a hill which overlooked the principal road leading out of Spain and into France. Along this road, they assured Strange, Major Grant and his captors were sure to pass. Sileneal's men set up camp nearby and settled themselves to wait. On the third day, they saw a large party of French soldiers coming along the road, and riding in the middle of them, in his scarlet uniform, was Major Grant. Immediately, Strange gave instructions for his coffin to be opened. Three of the guerrilleros took crowbars and prized off the lid. Inside, they found a pottery person, a sort of mannequin made from the same rough red clay which the Spanish use to make their colourful plates and jugs. It was life-size, but very crudely made. It had two holes for eyes and no nose to speak of. It was, however, carefully dressed in the uniform of an officer of the 11th Foot. "Now," said Strange to Geronimo Sileneal, "when the French outriders reach that rock there, take your men and attack them." Sileneal took a moment to digest this, not the least because Strange's Spanish had several eccentricities of grammar and pronunciation. When he had understood, he asked,
"Shall we try to free El Bueno Granto?"
El Bueno Granto was the Spaniard's name for Major Grant.
"Certainly not," replied Strange. "Leave El Bueno Granto to me."
Sileneal and his men went halfway down the hill to a place where thin trees made a screen that hid them from the road. From here, they opened fire. The French were taken entirely by surprise. Some were killed, many others wounded. There were no rocks and very few bushes, scarcely anywhere to hide. But the road was still before them, offering a good chance of outrunning their attackers. After a few minutes of panic and confusion, the French gathered up their wits and their wounded and sped away. As the guerrilleros climbed back up the hill, they were very doubtful that anything had been accomplished. After all, the figure in the scarlet uniform had still been among the Frenchmen as they rode off. They reached the place where they had left the magician and were amazed to find he was no longer alone. Major Grant was with him. The two men were sitting sociably on a rock, eating cold chicken and drinking claret.
"Brighton is all very well," Major Grant was saying, "but I prefer Weymouth."
"You amaze me," replied Strange. "I detest Weymouth. I spent one of the most miserable weeks of my life there. I was horribly in love with a girl called Marianne, and she snubbed me for a fellow with an estate in Jamaica and a glass eye.
That is not Weymouth's fault, said Major Grant. Ah, Capitan Sarnil.
He waved a chicken leg at the chieftain by way of greeting.
Buenos dias.
Meanwhile, the officers and soldiers of the French escort continued on their way to France, and when they reached Bayonne, they delivered their prisoner into the keeping of the head of Bayonne's secret police. The head of the secret police came forward to greet what he confidently believed to be Major Grant. He was somewhat disconcerted when, on reaching out to shake the major's hand, the entire arm came away in his hand. So surprised was he that he dropped it on the ground, where it shattered into 1,000 pieces. He turned to make his apologies to Major Grant, and was even more appalled to discover large black cracks appearing all over the major's face. Next, part of the major's head fell off, by which means he was discovered to be completely hollow inside. And a moment later, he fell to bits, like the Humpty Dumpty person in Mother Goose's melody. On July the 2nd, Wellington fought the French outside the ancient university city of Salamanca. It was the most decisive victory for any British army in recent years. That night, the French army fled through the woods that lay to the south of Salamanca. As they ran, the soldiers looked up and were amazed to see flights of angels descending through the dark trees. The angels shone with a blinding light. Their wings were as white as swan's wings, and their robes were the shifting colours of mother-of-pearl, fish scales, or skies before thunder. In their hands they held flaming lances, and their eyes blazed with a divine fury. They flew through the trees with astonishing rapidity, and brandished their lances in the faces of the French. Many of the soldiers were stricken with such terror that they turned and ran back toward the city, towards the pursuing British army. Most were too amazed to do anything but stand and stare. One man, braver and more resolute than the rest, tried to understand what was happening. It seemed to him highly unlikely that heaven should suddenly have allied itself with France's enemies. After all, such a thing had not been heard of since Old Testament times. He noticed that though the angels threatened the soldiers with their lances, they did not attack them. He waited until one of the angels swooped down towards him, and then plunged his sabre into it. The sabre encountered no resistance, nothing but empty air. Nor did the angel exhibit any signs of hurt or shock. Immediately, the Frenchman called out to his compatriots that there was no reason to be afraid. These were nothing but illusions produced by Wellington's magician. They could not harm them. The French soldiers continued along the road, pursued by the phantom angels. As they came out of the trees, they found themselves on the bank of the river Tormes. An ancient bridge crossed the river, leading into the town of Alba de Tormes. By an error on the part of one of Lord Wellington's allies, this bridge had been left entirely unguarded. The French crossed over and escaped through the town. Some hours later, shortly after dawn, Lord Wellington rode wearily across the bridge at Alba de Tormes. With him were three other gentlemen. Lieutenant Colonel de Lancy, who was the army's deputy quartermaster, a handsome young man called Fitzroy Somerset, who was Lord Wellington's military secretary, and Jonathan Strange. All of them were dusty and battle-stained, and none of them had been to bed for some days. Nor was there much likelihood of their doing so soon, since Wellington was determined to continue his pursuit of the fleeing French. The town, with its churches, convents, and medieval buildings, stood out with perfect clarity against an opalescent sky. Despite the hour, it was not much after 5:30, the town was already up. Bells were already being rung to celebrate the defeat of the French. Regiments of weary British and Portuguese soldiers were filing through the streets, and the townspeople were coming out of their houses to press gifts of bread, fruit, and flowers on them. Carts bearing wounded men were lined up against a wall, while the officer in charge sent men to seek out the hospital and other places to receive them. Meanwhile, 5 or 6 plain-faced, capable-looking nuns had arrived from one of the convents and were going around among the wounded men, giving them draughts of fresh milk from a tin cup. Small boys, whom nobody could persuade to stay in bed, were excitedly cheering every soldier they saw and forming impromptu victory parades behind any that did not seem to mind it. Lord Wellington looked about him. "Watkins!" he cried, hailing a soldier in an artillery uniform.
"Yes, my lord," said the man.
"I'm in search of my breakfast, Watkins. I don't suppose you have seen my cook."
"Sergeant Jefford said he saw your people going up to the castle, my lord."
"Thank you, Watkins," said his lordship, and rode on with his party.
The castle of Alba de Tormes was not much of a castle. Many years ago, at the start of the war, the French had laid siege to it, and with the exception of one tower, it was all in ruins. Birds and wild creatures now made nests and holes where once the Dukes of Alba had lived in unimaginable luxury. The fine Italian murals, for which the castle had once been famous, were a great deal less impressive now that the ceilings were all gone, and they'd been subjected to the rough caresses of rain, hail, sleet, and snow. The dining parlour lacked some of the convenience that other dining parlours have. It was open to the sky, and there was a young birch tree growing in the middle of it. But this troubled Lord Wellington's servants not one whit. They were accustomed to serve his lordship his meals in far stranger places. They had set a table beneath the birch tree and spread it with a white cloth. As Wellington and his companions rode up to the castle, they had just begun to lay it with plates of bread rolls, slices of Spanish ham, bowls of apricots, and dishes of fresh butter. Wellington's cook went off to fry fish, devil kidneys, and make coffee. The four gentlemen sat down. Colonel De Lancey remarked that he did not believe he could remember when his last meal had been. Somebody else agreed, and then they all silently applied themselves to the serious business of eating and drinking. They were just beginning to feel a little more like their usual selves and grow a little more conversational when Major Grant arrived.
"Ah, Grant," said Lord Wellington. "Good morning. Sit down. Have some breakfast."
"I will in a moment, my lord, but first I have some news for you, of a rather surprising sort. It seems the French have lost 6 cannon."
"Cannon?" said his lordship, not much interested.
He helped himself to a bread roll and some devil kidneys.
"Of course they have lost cannon. Somerset," he said, addressing his military secretary, "how many pieces of French cannon did I capture yesterday?"
11, my lord."
"No, no, my lord," said Major Grant. "I beg your pardon, but you misunderstand. I am not speaking of the cannon that were captured during the battle. These cannon were never in the battle. They were on their way from General Caffarelli in the north to the French army. But they did not arrive in time for the battle. In fact, they never arrived at all. Knowing that you were in the vicinity, my lord, and pressing the French hard, General Caffarelli was anxious to deliver them with all dispatch. He made up his escort out of the first 30 soldiers that came to hand. Well, my lord, he acted in haste and has repented at leisure, for it seems that 10 out of 30 were Neapolitan."
"Neapolitan? Were they indeed?" said his lordship.
De Lancey and Somerset exchanged pleased looks with one another, and even Jonathan Strange smiled. The truth was that although Naples was part of the French Empire, the Neapolitans hated the French. The young men of Naples were forced to fight in the French army, but they took every opportunity they could to desert, often running away to the enemy.
"But what of the other soldiers?" asked Somerset.
"Surely we must assume that they will prevent the Neapolitans doing much mischief."
"It is too late for the other soldiers to do anything," said Major Grant. "They are all dead. 20 pairs of French boots and 20 French uniforms are at this very moment hanging in the shop of an old clothes dealer in Salamanca. The coats all have long slits in the back, such as might be made by an Italian stiletto, and they are all over bloodstains."
"So, the cannon are in the hands of a pack of Italian deserters, are they?" said Strange. "What will they do? Start a war of their own?"
"No, no," said Grant. "They'll sell them to the highest bidder, either to you, my lord, or to General Castanos."
This was the name of the general in charge of the Spanish army.
"Somerset," said his lordship, "what ought I to give for 6 French cannon? $400?
"Oh, it is certainly worth $400 to make the French feel the consequences of their foolishness, my lord. But what I do not understand is why we have not heard something from the Neapolitans already. What can they be waiting for?"
"I believe I know the answer to that,"
said Major Grant.
4 nights ago, 2 men met secretly in a little graveyard upon a hillside not far from Kestrelholm. They wore ragged French uniforms and spoke a sort of Italian. They conferred a while, and when they parted, one went south towards the French army at Cantalapiedra, and the others went north towards the Duero. My lord, it is my belief that the Neapolitan deserters are sending messages to their countrymen to come and join them. I dare say they believe that with the money that you or General Castanos will give them for the guns, they will all be able to sail back to Naples in a golden ship. There is probably not a man among them who does not have a brother or cousin in some other French regiment. They do not wish to return home and face their mothers and grandmothers without bringing their relations with them.
I have always heard that Italian women are rather fierce, agreed Colonel De Lancey.
All we need to do, my lord, continued Major Grant, is to find some Neapolitans and question them. I am certain we will find that they know where the thieves are and where the guns are.
Are there any Neapolitans among yesterday's prisoners? Asked Wellington.
Colonel De Lancey sent a man to find out.
Of course, continued Wellington thoughtfully. It would suit me much better to pay nothing at all. Merlin?
This was his name for Jonathan Strange.
If you will be so good as to conjure up a vision of the Neapolitans, perhaps we'll gain some clue as to where they and the guns are to be found, and then we can simply go and get them.
Perhaps, said Strange.
I dare say there will be an oddly shaped mountain in the background, said his lordship cheerfully, or a village with a distinctive church tower. One of the Spanish guides will soon recognize the place.
I dare say, said Strange.
You do not seem very sure of it.
Forgive me, my lord, but as I think I have said before, visions are precisely the wrong sort of magic for this sort of thing. Footnote 2. Jonathan Strange to John Segundus, Madrid, August the 20th, 1812. Whenever someone or something needs to be found, Lord Wellington is sure to ask me to conjure up a vision. It never works. The Raven King and the other Oriots had a sort of magic for finding things and persons. As I understand it, they began with a silver basin of water. They divided the surface of the water into quarters with glittering lines of light. By the by, John, I really cannot believe that you were having as much difficulty as you say in creating these lines. I cannot describe the magic any more clearly. They are the simplest things in the world. The quarters represent heaven, hell, earth and fairy. It seems that you employ a spell of election to establish in which of these realms the person or thing you seek is to be found. But how it goes on from there, I have not the least idea, and neither does Norrell. If I only had this magic. Wellington or his staff is forever giving me tasks which I cannot do, or which I must leave half completed because I do not have it. I feel the lack of it almost daily, yet I have no time for experiment. And so, John, I would be infinitely obliged to you if you could spend a little time attempting this spell, and let me know immediately if you have the least success. There is nothing in any of John Segundus's surviving papers to suggest that he had any success in his attempts to retrieve this magic. However, in the autumn of 1814, Strange realized that a passage in Paris Ormskirk's Revelations of 36 Other Worlds, long thought to be a description of a shepherd's counting rhyme, was in fact a somewhat garbled version of precisely this spell. By late 1814, both Strange and Mr. Norrell were performing this magic with confidence.
"Well, have you anything better to suggest?"
asked his lordship.
"No, my lord, not at present."
"Then it is decided," said Lord Wellington. "Mr. Strange, Colonel De Lancey, and Major Grant can turn their attention to the discovery of these guns. Somerset and I will go and annoy the French."
The brisk manner in which his lordship spoke suggested that he expected all of these things to start happening very soon. Strange and the gentlemen of the staff swallowed the rest of their breakfast and went to their various tasks. At about midday, Lord Wellington and Fitzroy Somerset were seated upon their horses on a slight ridge near the village of Garcia Hernandez. On the stony plain below, several brigades of British dragoons were preparing to charge some squadrons of cavalry which formed the rearguard of the French army. Just then, Colonel De Lancey rode up.
"Ah, Colonel," said Lord Wellington. "Have you found me any Neapolitans?"
"There are no Neapolitans among the prisoners, my lord," said Delancey. "But Mr. Strange suggested we look among the dead upon yesterday's battlefield. By magical means, he has identified 17 corpses as Neapolitan."
"Corpses?" said Lord Wellington, putting down his telescope in surprise. "What in the world does he want corpses for?"
"We asked him that, my lord, but he grew evasive and would not answer. However, he has asked that the dead men be put somewhere safe, where they will be neither lost nor molested."
"Well, I suppose one ought not to employ a magician and then complain that he does not behave like other people," said Wellington.
At that moment, an officer standing close by cried out that the dragoons had increased their pace to a gallop and would soon be upon the French. Instantly, the eccentricities of the magician were forgotten. Lord Wellington put his telescope to his eye, and every man present turned his attention to the battle. Strange, meanwhile, had returned from the battlefield to the castle at Alba de Tormes. In the armory tower, the only part of the castle still standing, he had found a room that no one was using, and had appropriated it. Scattered about the room were Norrell's 40 books. They were all still more or less in one piece, though some were decidedly battered-looking. The floor was covered with Strange's notebooks and pieces of paper with scraps of spells and magical calculations scribbled on them. On a table in the centre of the room stood a wide and shallow silver bowl filled with water. The shutters had been pulled tight, and the only light in the room came from the silver bowl. All in all, it was a veritable magician's cave, and the pretty Spanish maid who brought coffee and almond biscuits at regular intervals was quite terrified, and ran out again as soon as she had put down her trays. An officer of the 18th Hussars, called White, had arrived to assist Strange. Captain White had lived for some time at the house of the British envoy in Naples. He was adept at languages and understood the Neapolitan dialect perfectly. Strange had no difficulty in conjuring up the visions, but just as he had predicted, the visions gave very little clue as to where the men were. The guns, he discovered, were half hidden behind some pale yellow rocks, the sort of rocks which were scattered liberally throughout the peninsula, and the men were camped in a sparse woodland of olive and pine trees, the sort of woodland, in fact, that one might discover by casting one's glance in any direction. Captain White stood at Strange's side and translated everything the Neapolitan said into clear, concise English. But though they stared into the silver bowl all day, they learnt very little. When a man has been hungry for 18 months, when he has not seen his wife or sweetheart for 2 years, when he has spent the last 4 months sleeping upon mud and stones, his powers of conversation tend to be somewhat dulled. The Neapolitans had very little to say to each other, and what they did say chiefly concerned the food they wished they were eating, the charms of the absent wives and sweethearts they wished they were enjoying, and the soft feather mattresses they wished they were sleeping upon. For half the night and most of the following day, Strange and Captain White remained in the armory tower, engaged in the dull work of watching the Neapolitans. Towards the evening of the second day, an aide-de-camp brought a message from Wellington. His lordship had set up his headquarters at a place called Flores de Avila, and Strange and Captain White were summoned to attend him there. So they packed up Strange's books and the silver bowl and gathered their other possessions and set off along the hot, dusty roads. Flores de Avila proved to be rather an obscure place. None of the Spanish men and women whom Captain White accosted had heard of it. But when two of Europe's greatest armies have recently travelled along a road, they cannot help but leave some signs of their passing. Strange and Captain White found that their best plan was to follow the trail of discarded baggage, broken carts, corpses, and feasting black birds. Against a background of empty stone-strewn plains, these sights resembled nothing so much as images from a medieval painting of hell, and they provoked Strange to make a great many gloomy remarks upon the horror and futility of war. Ordinarily, Captain White, a professional soldier, would have felt inclined to argue, but he too was affected by the somber character of their surroundings, and only answered, "Very true, sir, very true." But a soldier ought not to dwell too long on such matters. His life is full of hardship, and he must take his pleasures where he can. Though he may take time to reflect upon the cruelties that he sees, place him among his comrades, and it is almost impossible for his spirits not to rise. Strange and Captain White reached Flores de Avila at about 9 o'clock, and within 5 minutes they were greeting their friends cheerfully, listening to the latest gossip about Lord Wellington, and making a great many inquiries about the previous day's battle. Another defeat for the French. One would scarcely suppose they had seen anything to distress them within the last 12 months. The headquarters had been set up in a ruined church on a hillside above the village, and there Lord Wellington, Fitzroy Somerset, Colonel de Lancey, and Major Grant were waiting to meet them. For all that he had won 2 battles in as many days, Lord Wellington was not in the best of tempers. The French army, famed throughout Europe for the rapidity of its marches, had got away from him, and was now well on the way to Valladolid and safety.
"It is a perfect mystery to me how they get on so fast," he complained, "and I would give a great deal to catch up with them and destroy them. But this is the only army I have, and if I wear it out, I cannot get another."
"We have heard from the Neapolitans with the guns," Major Grant informed Strange and Captain White. "They're asking $100 apiece for them, $600 in all."
"Which is too much," said his lordship briefly. "Mr. Strange, Captain White, I hope you have good news for me."
"Hardly, my lord," said Strange. "The Neapolitans are in a wood, but as to where that wood might be, I have not the least idea. I am not sure how to progress. I've exhausted everything I know."
"Then you must quickly learn something else."
For a moment, Strange looked as if he were going to return his lordship an angry reply, but thinking better of it, he sighed and inquired whether the 17 dead Neapolitans were being kept safe.
"They've been put in the bell tower," said Colonel de Lancey. "Sergeant Nash has charge of them. Whatever you want them for, I advise you to use them soon. I doubt they will last much longer in this heat."
"They will last another night," said Strange. "The nights are cold." Then he turned and went out of the church. Wellington's staff watched him go with some curiosity.
"You know," said Fitzroy Somerset, "I really cannot help wondering what he's going to do with 17 corpses.
"Whatever it is," said Wellington,
dipping his quill in the ink and beginning a letter to the ministers in London,
"he does not relish the thought of it. He is doing everything he can to avoid it."
That night, Strange did a sort of magic he had never done before. He attempted to penetrate the dreams of the Neapolitan company. In this, he was perfectly successful. One man dreamt that he was chased up a tree by a vicious roast leg of lamb. He sat in the tree, weeping with hunger, while the leg of lamb ran round and round and thrust its knob of bone at him in a menacing way. Shortly after, the leg of lamb was joined by 5 or 6 spiteful boiled eggs, who whispered the most dreadful lies about him. Another man dreamt that, as he was walking through a little wood, he met his dead mother. She told him that she had just looked down a rabbit hole and seen Napoleon Bonaparte, the King of England, the Pope, and the Tsar of Russia at the bottom. The man went down the rabbit hole to see, but when he arrived at the bottom, he discovered that Napoleon Bonaparte, the King of England, the Pope, and the Tsar of Russia were, in fact, all the same person, a huge, blubbering great man as big as a church, with rusty iron teeth and burning cartwheels for eyes.
"Ah," sneered this ogre, "you did not think we were really different people, did you?"
And it reached into a bubbling cauldron that stood nearby and pulled out the dreamer's little son and ate him. In short, the Neapolitan's dreams, though interesting, were not very illuminating.